The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our blind and print-impaired audience. It's Indie Week, the weekly publication read today by John Federson. And this issue week for the week is dated June the 15th of 2022. Beautiful music on that theme song today is being rendered by our musical saw virtuoso Constantine / McMulligan, along with his piano accompanist is Lurleen Stubbs Fiorentino. Beautiful job, folks. And we have finally arrived at the mid-June issue of Indie Week and IndieWeek.com online, containing the Best of the Triangle Awards. And this is a voluminous listing of listener and reader sponsored votes for the best of a huge variety of categories. There's hundreds of little mentions of restaurants, services, and what have you. And whatever time is left at the end of this broadcast, I'll start reading those, and I'll probably save this issue to go into more of them in future weeks. First, we'll go right to, though, to our first news in the print edition by Jasmine Gallup, titled The Price of Policing. At a public hearing last week, a young black mother was among the more than 30 people who stood in line at the podium to protest a nearly $8 million budget increase proposed for the Raleigh Police Department. Nike Williams carried her young daughter in her arms as she waited to give her 2 cents on the city's annual budget. She said, "In the last 5 years, the Raleigh Police Department has brutalized hundreds of people. Murder and violence against my community is common for the Raleigh PD. As a black woman, it is extremely painful to see the unwarranted vendetta police have against black and brown people. As this body increases the police budget by the millions year after year, it becomes apparent that the city council members have a high tolerance for police violence and a reckless disregard for the safety of me and my loved ones." Williams' 1 minute of speaking time quickly ran out, but her daughter got the last word in before the two departed the chambers. "I want to be safe," said the girl, wearing a pink scrunchie in her hair. The sincere plea from Williams and her daughter didn't change the minds of council members, though. They passed the city's $1.1 billion budget Monday, complete with a funding increase for the RPD in a 6-2 vote, despite vehement protests from community activists and police officers. Council members David Cox and Patrick Bufkin were the two dissenters. Cox said the budget didn't do enough for public safety workers and spent too much on projects like the new city hall and community engagement bus. Bufkin said the pay raises for law enforcement don't meet the needs of the moment. In the fight over the Raleigh police budget, there were two camps. First, the community activists, many of whom are black and brown, who argued the budget should be cut to make room for a mental health crisis response unit and a raise for other city workers. Refund Raleigh, a local community group, led the effort in demanding the city divest from police and invest in community safety. Second, there's the Raleigh Police and Firefighter Associations, who demanded pay increases amid severe staff shortages. In RPD, there are currently 168 vacancies, about 20% of the total force, according to Matthew Cooper, president of the Raleigh Police Protective Association, RPPA. The department has lost about 77 officers, 30 of them senior, since 2020, Cooper wrote in a letter to the city. Quote, "Neighboring municipalities have prioritized funding for public safety, offering substantial raises and benefits to prospective applicants, while Raleigh has fallen further behind with no tangible commitments for compensation. Raleigh officers have left our department to these neighboring departments." The heart of the struggle was over how to keep people safe in Raleigh, with or without police. Police Chief Estella Patterson, who replaced former Chief Cassandra Deck Brown in August, wrote in a statement that an investment in police services is necessary in keeping Raleigh safe for all. Going on, RPD is committed to working in partnership with the community to reduce crime and build trust with all who live, work, learn, and play in our city. The divesting of funds from the police may limit these efforts and impact services for those who need it most, specifically in areas where there have been increases in crime. The police department has undergone some reforms since 2020, including instituting a ban on choke holds and strangle holds and creating the ACORNS unit. That's addressing crisis through outreach, referrals, networking, and service, which is made up of 6 law enforcement officers and 3 social workers. Unlike some other non-police teams, however, the unit responds to people in crisis only after they have interacted with traditional armed police officers. After an interaction on the street, an officer may call in the unit to help someone connect with resources like shelter and counseling. With such modest reforms, it's unsurprising police violence has continued. 3 years after Raleigh police shot and killed Soil Mojarrad, a man with mental health challenges, officers shot and killed Daniel Turcios, a man who was walking away from a rollover traffic accident. Just 4 months later, in May, officers shot and killed another man, Ruel Rodriguez Nunez, after he threw flammable objects at police vehicles. Body camera footage shows Master Officer P.W. Coates shouting, do it, at Rodriguez Nunez, who may have been attempting suicide by cop. Rodriguez Nunez's brother, Shaziel Rodriguez Nunez, said Friday his brother was experiencing a mental health crisis and officers failed to handle it appropriately. He and local activists, including Dawn Blagrove and Kerwin Pittman of Emancipate NC, called for RPD to fire Coates, revoke his law enforcement certification, and remove his pay while he is placed on administrative leave. Pittman said during the news conference, individuals were de-escalating the situation, but yet he chose to escalate it and essentially provoke and bully somebody having a mental health crisis. If someone who is having a mental health crisis and standing on the ledge of a bridge about to jump, this was akin to this officer running over there and telling him, jump, jump, go ahead, do it, go ahead, do it. Emancipate NC is also demanding that every RPD officer undergo de-escalation, crisis intervention, and character training. Blagrove also joined Refund Raleigh's calls to defund the police and establish a non-police crisis response team. He said, Master Officer P.W. Coates lusted for any pretext to murder a mentally unstable man with suicidal ideations. Give me the go-ahead, he said. This murderer is now on leave with pay from Raleigh Police Department, Blagrove said during the hearing. Instead of paying killer cops and increasing the city police budget, which is the single largest budget allocation, choose to invest in real safety. You have done what is easy. Now do what is right. Following the recent uptick in police violence, the department is now considering a new policy to de-escalate situations before officers resort to use of force. The policy would include more training for officers with the goal of reducing the frequency and amount of force used by police. But activist Ajamu Dillahunt, who's been keeping a close eye on the 2 fatal shootings carried out by RPD this year, argues the city needs to cut ties with a broken police department and look for other solutions. Quote, the police cannot be a container for the things we need in order for our communities to thrive. The de-escalation that has supposedly been attempted is just not adequate. The institution is deeply flawed and has a history of racist and brutalizing tactics. Refund Raleigh proposed the city council invest in a crisis response program similar to Denver's Support Team Assistant Response, the STAR program, which responds to nonviolent 9/11 calls instead of police officers. In the 2 years since the STAR unit started, mental health clinicians and paramedics have responded to more than 2,700 calls, reported the Denver Post. They've helped people experiencing homelessness, people who are suicidal, those who have mental health illness, and people using drugs. They've connected people with shelter, food, and resources, all with zero arrests and no police violence. In light of the program's success, Denver city officials are now expanding that program with hopes they can respond to more than 10,000 calls a year. Dillahunt said, "Denver's program has been so successful because it's independent. It's been able to go directly to people in crisis. The way ACORNS functions is that it has to get approval from the police, and it's coordinated through them. So the police have the final say. We believe that an independent unit will help keep our communities much safer." Refund Raleigh also proposed the city raise wages for city workers to $22 an hour, citing studies that show raising the minimum wage reduces crime. A 2016 White House study by the Council of Economic Advisers found, quote, "higher wages for low-skilled workers reduce both property and violent crime, as well as crime among adolescents." Raleigh's current minimum wage for workers is $13.76 an hour, $4.60 below the city's living wage for an adult with no children, which is $18.36, according to calculations by the MIT. For a single adult with one child, the hourly wage they need to live normally climbs to nearly $36. Economic justice is a key factor in reducing crime and violence, says Dillahunt. Much crime happens because people are doing what they can to survive in a world where they don't have the resources to support themselves or their family. Quote, "when people don't have what they need to survive, they will do things to get what they need. When people have what they need to survive, that prevents crime. The city is constantly getting more expensive to live in, but the wages for people are not changing. When people have housing, jobs, quality education, and quality health care, the world is a better place." Refund Raleigh argues that higher wages for city workers will also help improve neighborhoods, parks, and infrastructure, and help grow programs like summer youth camps and after-school tutoring. Meanwhile, Cooper and other police officers argued the only way to keep Raleigh residents safe is to keep the police department fully funded and staffed, with additional funding this year to help attract qualified law enforcement officers. During the public hearing, Cooper said, "the rise in violent crime in our city is becoming impossible to ignore. Raleigh is running neck and neck with Durham in the number of homicides this year. Staffing shortages make patrol operations nearly unmanageable. The department is being forced to pull resources from other areas to supplement voids in service. When this happens, everyone suffers. The problem is not going away." Since the start of this year, 20 homicides have been reported in Durham, only one more than the 19 reported in Raleigh. The Raleigh City Council has steadily increased the police department budget over the last 5 years, from $97 million in fiscal 2016-17 to $117 million in 21-22 to $124.5 million this year. That's an increase of about 7% over last year. The budget includes $545,000 for police cars and the replacement of aging equipment, $300,000 for a new digital evidence storage and tracking system, $295,000 for improvements to police vehicles, and $275,000 for a one-time boost to contractual services for the department's promotional process. The budget also includes $100,000 for the Raleigh Youth Summit and $6,000 for training on crime prevention through environmental design. The biggest chunk of funding, however, about $5.5 million, is going to a 2% cost of living raise for all full-time department employees, 3 to 5% increase in merit pay and an 18 to 51% increase in starting pay for police, depending on the position, said Rick Armstrong of the RPPA. They said the city plan overlooks experienced officers. Armstrong and others instead asked for a 10% raise for officers across the board, including detectives and sergeants, plus a 3 to 5% raise for lieutenants, captains, and majors. Police also asked for the ability to be paid overtime instead of earning days off to help with staffing shortages. The association's proposed pay raises would cost between $5.3 and $5.5 million, about the same amount of money the city is currently proposing to spend on raises, city staff wrote in a memo. The association's proposal for overtime pay would cost the city an additional $3.3 million. The council ultimately didn't meet officers' demands. Bufkin brought a motion on Monday to further increase law enforcement pay by raising the tax rate by an additional half cent to 2.5 cents total. The motion failed, with only Bufkin and David Knight voting in favor. Knight said Monday that Refund Raleigh's public comments were, quote, inaccurate and inappropriate. They were egregious, and they were over the line, and I apologize to our public safety workers and first responders for not speaking out during the public hearing, said Knight. It's notable that during this year's budget process, the council considered the RPPA's demand and ignored Refund Raleigh's proposal. Although the council didn't further raise officer pay, officers entering the department this year will receive higher wages than ever. Council members also voted to put excess money in the budget toward officer raises next year to ensure they receive a minimum 10% increase over a two-year period. But will better trained, better equipped, and better paid police officers really keep black and brown people safe? History suggests not. Even if RPD were to adopt more aggressive reforms, there's been little evidence in other cities and towns that anti-bias training, community policing initiatives, or de-escalation policies work to reduce police violence. Raleigh's own history of violence and reform is itself a record of failure. A new police chief hasn't helped. The Police Advisory Board, created 2 years ago, lacks the power to make real change and is now completely symbolic after two members resigned last year. Shootings keep happening. Dillahunt says, we're in a unique time. The tide is shifting and people are seeing it for themselves. Why money should be taken away from the bloated police budget put into social programs. Next, from Wake County, Marina Fabian, Hurt Pride. Last year, the House of Cox, COXX, a drag collective based in the Triangle, planned a family event to take place at the Cary Theater, located in downtown Cary, for Pride Month, scheduled for April 1. Rafe Pernsley, a member of the House of Cox, said he was extremely excited to finally introduce Cary to drag, especially to those who had no exposure to it before. He says, we were going to read and talk about the history of drag in the LGBTQ community. The event was really to introduce families to drag in a more in-depth and genuine way. Drag Queen Story Hours are family events that are hosted by drag queens who read books to children. Pernsley says he had intended it for it to be family-forward, and even modeled the drag queen's performances around some Disney songs that the kids would recognize. Surface Pressure from Encanto was on the set list. Days before the event, Pernsley received a message out of the blue informing him that the theater show was no longer happening. The town of Cary owns the Cary Theater, and events are administered by the town's Department of Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Resources. Some Cary locals, including Emanuela Prister, a lawyer active with Wake County GOP, had complained. On March 16th, Prister sent a strongly worded email to Cary Town Manager Sean Stiegel about the use of derogatory language in the Queen's stage names, arguing the names referenced body parts and sex acts and were inappropriate for children. The email stated, it is in fact grooming. It is criminal in nature and nefarious and not acceptable in a civil society. In his response the same day, Stiegel said he was not aware that the theater had been rented for the event and that he, quote, decided to terminate the show the use of vulgar language and its promotion to children. While the town supports and wants to encourage diversity in its offerings, certainly not in this form or manner, Stiegel wrote. He didn't respond to a request for comment from the Indy. Following the cancellation of Carrie's event, more Triangle locals started harassing and sending violent threats to the organizers of Apex Pride, according to Burnsley. A drag queen story hour scheduled this month was originally canceled for Apex Pride due to homophobic backlash from some residents. Equality NC stepped in to sponsor the event and took over the annual Apex Pride Festival, and the story went on as planned this Saturday. Drag Queen Story Hour, DQSH, North Carolina chapter leader Mary Elise says she knows how much kids love these events and how significant Drag Queen Story Hours are for them, saying, some kids just love it because it's another story time, but for other kids, it's a life-changing experience. They need to see this representation, whether it may be someone with the same skin color as them or someone who might present their gender differently. There are so many different ways that we represent people in our story hour and our stories. Elise says Drag Queen Story Hour isn't just about talking to children about pride or LGBTQ issues. On the DQSH website bookshop, recommended book lists include various sections not solely focused on LGBTQ pride. In fact, some of the lists involve themes such as self-expression, what makes a family, and the amplification of black and brown voices. Unfortunately, the cancellations of these story hours of events were not the only acts of discrimination occurring across Wake County during this Pride Month. In Holly Springs, first-term Republican Mayor Sean Mayefsky refused to make a proclamation for Pride Month and refused to join Wake County and other municipalities in enacting a non-discrimination ordinance for its residents. Carrie Renda, a resident of Holly Springs and a 2021 town council candidate, says she reached out to Mayefsky in April to ask if Holly Springs would be signing on to the NDO and issuing a Pride proclamation. Mayefsky didn't engage much with Randa, but he did send her one response saying, I am aware of the LGBTQ community, and nothing else. Randa says, I sent statistics on why I thought a Pride proclamation was important, especially for LGBTQ youth. A lot of those statistics were about mental health impact, suicide rates, all sorts of things to show why this proclamation is important for our town. Randa continued following up with Mayefsky and included screenshots of hateful comments left on a Pride event Facebook post that was scheduled to take place in neighboring town Fuquay-Varina in the correspondence. The mayor responded that he didn't think a proclamation would curb hate speech, but said that he is adamantly against it. Mayefsky didn't respond to requests for comment from Indy. Randa started a petition on May 26 to see if she could convince the town's leadership that Holly Springs residents want to be considered inclusive and welcoming. Randa received more than 500 signatures and planned to present the petition to the town council during its June 7th meeting and demand an explanation as to why the town wouldn't issue that proclamation. Before the council meeting took place on May 31st, Randa and a town council member, Christy Bennett, had a meeting to discuss the proclamation and NDO. Randa says they didn't reach an agreement, but she left the meeting feeling like it was a good conversation. But on June 5th, Bennett made a Facebook post about refusing to make the proclamation and told her followers to come rally against Aranda at the town council meeting. The post read, "It would do a lot for our town to see one or more residents speaking on the opposite side of the issue. If you're willing to take a moment and write an email to the mayor and council in support of not adopting the NDO or declaring June Pride Month in Holly Springs, I know myself and others would probably appreciate the support. Thank you." Bennett did not respond to the Indy's request for comments. Randa says, "It's a little embarrassing, I guess, in 2022 and we're still fighting this battle." A live stream from the June 7 Holly Spring Council meeting shows Randa and several others speaking about why a Pride Month proclamation is much needed. Speakers ranging from young people to longtime residents said they were disappointed, angry, and upset that the council would not issue this proclamation. Randa told the council, "In this inaction, one can only conclude that Holly Springs has decided that some of its most vulnerable citizens are just not worth the effort and don't require the same protections afforded to everyone else. Pride Month is meant to acknowledge difference, promote acceptance, and show and welcome diversity." Outright homophobia is something that Prinsley says he has experienced before, but he says it's ridiculous it still occurs in the Triangle in 2022. He says he also didn't anticipate this kind of backlash or locals' response to the planned story hours because the events had in the past been welcoming and joyful events for children and adults. Prinsley said, "It was not lost on me the picking and choosing this community continuously does every year when it comes to the protection of our children, specifically with the reality and the threats that real children in schools are facing, gun violence, food security, and inaccessibility to school supplies." Elise says she worries about the new initiatives from lawmakers targeting LGBTQ community, such as the so-called Parents' Bill of Rights, also known as the Don't Say Gay Bill. She says proposed legislation like that frightens and angers her. Quote, "It worries me that children out there will identify with what you don't want talked about at school." But in spite of the backlash in some of the more conservative corners of Wake, Pride events do go on as planned and proudly in Raleigh, Durham, and Orange counties. And now, Tomasi McDonald from Durham, a shining light. The theme for Durham's second annual Juneteenth, Keeping the Fire Lit, is inspired by a monument that honors the former Lincoln Hospital School of Nursing that first opened in 1901 in the Haiti district. Angel Isette Dozier, one of the Juneteenth organizers and founder of the nonprofit Be Connected, which addresses inequities in communities, says the theme resonates with the Lincoln Hospital Monument in that it recognizes how rapidly the city of Durham is changing. He says, "And we want to emphasize the story of Haiti as a beacon, shining light on a more equitable version of Durham, as a city that resists a form of renewal that do not serve all of Durham across intersections." The nearly 7-foot-high granite obelisk topped by a large metal oil lamp sits on the verdant oak tree-shaded lawn in front of the current Lincoln Community Health Center. The memorial, erected in 2005, shares its space with a commemorative plaque in the curving hourglass-shaped area defined by small white and brown rocks dotted by larger, smoother black rocks. Dozier says, "It's known in the community as the genie lamp. You rub it 3 times and make your wish." This week's celebration in Haiti are spearheaded by the nonprofit Village of Wisdom, VOW, a Haiti-based education equity nonprofit that works to eliminate racism in the classroom. VOW held its first Juneteenth event at Haiti Heritage Center in 2019 and partnered in 2021 with Be Connected, which curates the Fayetteville Street Corridor Fellows Project, live Haiti's third Friday art and business walk. This year's celebrations have been expanded to include partnerships with Spectacular Magazine, the state's representative with the National Juneteenth Committee, and the Bragg-Town Neighborhood Association. Urban sprawl will take on new meaning this weekend. Friday's events along the Fayetteville Street corridor will take place at the Hyte Heritage Center, the historic Algonquin Club, College Inn, and the W.D. Hill Recreation Center in the 1300 block of Fayetteville Street, according to a press release. On Saturday, the Golden Belt Campus in East Durham will feature music and messages from the National Juneteenth Committee, hosted by Spectacular Magazine. And on Sunday, Spectacular will host a barbecue cook-off. One could ostensibly grab a barbecue plate on Sunday afternoon and then head over to a gospel festival in Bragg-Town, the oldest African-American community in the state, which was founded by formerly enslaved people who toiled at Stagville Plantation. The Bragg-Town Community Association will host its second annual Juneteenth-themed Inspiration over at Lakeview Park on Dearborn Drive, starting at 2 p.m. Dozier notes that last year's event in the Haiti community celebrated the presence of Erzuli, the Haitian Mother Mary and Goddess of Love, whose veve, a religious symbol, has adorned the steeple of that heritage center, formerly the church, for 130 years. It also celebrated the Haitian veve for Papa Legba, the spirit of the crossroads, who facilitates communication, which sits atop the William Robinson Science Building on the NC Central campus. Legba, sitting atop the science building, which was built in 1939, does not appear to be a happenstance occurrence. Both veves, spelled V-E-V-E, can be seen simultaneously while standing in front of the home of NCCU founder James E. Shepherd. The old church steeple appears to sit in the middle of Fayetteville Street, nearly a mile away. With the church's completion in 1891, roughly 90 years after the Haitian Revolution, one can only wonder if community leaders during that period were trying to transmit a message of self-sufficiency to future generations. Dozier says this year's theme is apt. Despite the broken promises of urban renewal and the threat of gentrification, quote, Haiti belongs to the black community. It's important that we continue the legacy, she says. The nursing school, which closed its doors in the 1970s, is yet another institution that succumbed to the broken promises of urban renewal in the historically black neighborhood and its early residents, whose community resilience and enterprise in the face of Jim Crow won the admiration of W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, two titans of civil rights who rarely agreed on anything. Juneteenth is the nation's oldest celebration commemorating the end of slavery. Historical records indicate not all former slaves in all parts of the country were freed by the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863, such as those living in the westernmost Confederate state of Texas. But freedom finally came on June 19, 1865, when some 2,000 Union troops arrived in Galveston Bay. The Army announced that the more than 250,000 enslaved black people in the state were freed by executive decree, and the day came to be known as Juneteenth by Texas's newly freed people. Dozier calls the holiday a significant event because it represents the ultimate microcosm of not getting information on time, the ultimate afterthought, especially in the Haiti neighborhood. Organizers of Durham's Juneteenth celebration say it's well past time to move beyond the symbols and instead fight for things that are much more substantive in a community that's now threatened by gentrification. The three-day event, which begins with the ongoing Third Friday at the Haiti Heritage Center and will feature a short film, Haiti Stories, a vendor's marketplace, spoken word performances, visual art, live jazz, hip-hop, dance, and drummers. Dozier says it's about using art as a vehicle for change and to promote healing in a once vibrant community that has been broken. However, she adds that the celebration will also emphasize the importance of activism, especially among the community's young people. The Haiti celebration will include a youth artists panel and feature the work of seven youngsters. It'll also focus on past efforts by community elders to sponsor youth activities, such as the near-legendary Algonquin Club, a, quote, social club and community center primarily for the African-American elite of Durham and Haiti. That club was organized in the 1920s. According to writer Dorothy Phelps Jones, the Algonquin Club, quote, voted to become a part of the Algonquin Tennis Club, which was the older organization, and emphasized social growth as one of its primary objectives. It was the group that brought Althea Gibson at the height of her fame as a tennis champion and bragged of Arthur Ashe as one of the youngsters who played on their tennis courts. The bourgeois has arrived. Dozier points to another little-known fact about the old Algonquin. Young people, with the help of adult members, built go-karts that they raced at soapbox derbies on a Jim Crow Chitlin circuit, but also nationally in integrated events during the 1930s and 40s. A 1963 story in a midsummer edition of the Carolina Times extolled the racing prowess of 15-year-old William Little Willie Bowman in a story headlined, Durham has its own Fireball Roberts, now Derby King. The event organizer says the go-karts were part of a sports mecca in that community, which included the W.D. Hill Recreation Center, Hillside Park, the old location of Hillside High School, and the Algonquin Club. The youngsters in the community were also supported by community business, including the now-closed College Inn and Scarborough and Hargett, one of the nation's oldest black-owned funeral services. Dozier says there is a spiritual kinship between the old go-kart kids and today's youth who ride their motorbikes along the Fayetteville Street corridor on Sundays. She explains, these young men are often criminalized for riding, but they actually have strong principles and significant cultural influence. One group calls them wheels up, guns down, because while they are experiencing joy and being themselves, they are also reminding us of our own cultural abundance. Dozier also points to last year when the city announced plans to demolish the Wheels Family Fun Park skating rink in East Durham that has been closed since 2020 and replace it with a state-of-the-art aquatics center and a park. Durham's youth responded by circulating a petition and collecting 1,100 signatures requesting the skating rink be included in the plan. The petition drive was led by youth fellows with the Fayetteville Street Corridor. This week, the 9th Street Journal reported that city council members were receptive to a multiracial group who requested that the skating rink, long a safe space for marginalized youth, be preserved and renovated. Dozier says this is how the city of Durham can be held accountable. Partner with the citizens of the city, and well you should be. Stories are at the heart of the Haiti District's healing and activism. Dozier says with the concept of memory as a way to heal and recall the codes and dreams of the ancestors. She says the community's blight was caused by the city and that its residents never received reparations from the misnamed urban renewal plan that demolished hundreds of homes and businesses to make way for Highway 147. She says, we don't have the capacity to sustain things. There's a reason for all of the nasty attention and crime. We are at overcapacity, and our people are tired of always having to turn something out of nothing. Despite the obstacles, Dozier alludes to the Juneteenth theme. Quote, the lamp reminds us of fire and light, powerful symbols for black communities, particularly in times of darkness and stagnation. We come from a place of cultural abundance. We build upon what is already here. Next, as we often do, we will move to the online edition of IndieWeek, IndieWeek.com, for a weather-related article, Wake County Opening Cooling Stations for Residents to Beat the Heat. Anyone who ventures outside in North Carolina can feel it this week, scorching, blistering heat that can only be beat by a cold blast of AC. Extreme temperatures and weather events brought on by climate change we've been hearing about for the last decade are here, and they're even more sweat-inducing than we ever imagined. So Wake County has opened multiple cooling stations, with the heat index values in and expected to remain in triple digits. Indoor spaces are already open. They're safe, air-conditioned havens to escape from the outdoors. But in Wake County, there are four designated cooling locations in Raleigh, Zebulon, Wake Forest, and Fuquay-Varina, open from 10 a.m. to around 5:15 p.m. to give people a place to sit in an air-conditioned room for as long as they need, with staff available to help. They can also seek help from refuge from the heat at any Wake County Public Library for indoor shelter and access to drinking water fountains. National Weather Service issued a heat warning for central North Carolina Tuesday, lasting from noon to 8 p.m. with a high temperature of 99 and a heat index values of 105 to 114 degrees. That's Tuesday. And, of course, there's tomorrow, which is actually, for our listening audience, is Friday, June 17th. June 18th. Wake County advises adults over 65, children under 4, and people with pre-existing medical condition without access to air conditioning are at the greatest risk during these days. So, this isn't the first time the county has opened cooling stations, and the local government will continue to do whatever's necessary in order to meet community needs going forward. Above all, the county hopes that anyone who is feeling unsafe or uncomfortable outside will take advantage of the cooling stations this week. Here's where these four locations are. And in Raleigh, the Wake County Human Services is at 220 Swinburne Street. The Eastern Regional Center is at 1002 Dogwood Drive in Zebulon. Over in Wake Forest, Northern Regional Center, 350 East Holding Avenue. And the Southern Regional Center is in Fuquay-Varina, 130 North Judd Parkway, Northeast. Those are four indoor spots where you can go to get air conditioning, water, and maybe a breeze, depending on if they put a fan up there. And that's it for you. Stay safe over this weekend. We may have a slight easing of temperatures on Saturday, but it's not going to be great for any stretch of time, that's for sure. Also from the online edition, news from North Carolina Central University. Two events this week will celebrate their photo archives. Officials announced that the campus will host two events this week to celebrate the historically black university's photo archives. Thursday afternoon, NC Central will kick off the implementation of a Getty Images grant that will allow the school to digitize and preserve rare imagery from its archival photographic library, according to a university press release. On Friday morning, university and state officials, along with community members and students, will gather at NC Central's James Shepherd Memorial Library for a virtual panel discussion to commemorate the Juneteenth celebration of emancipation from slavery. In January, the school announced it was one of four historically black colleges and universities across the country selected to receive a Getty Images Photo Archive grant for HBCUs. The grant program is part of Getty Images' commitment to anti-racism, inclusion, and dismantling discrimination, including bringing to market unseen historical content and creating revenue streams for organizations working to build a more inclusive society, the officials explained in the release. This year's program will support the digitization of up to 200,000 archival photos from the grant recipients, and those also include Claflin University in Orangeburg, South Carolina, Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi, Prairie View A&M in Prairie View, Texas. Officials from Getty Images will be on the campus Thursday to work side by side with school officials during this digitization process. NCCU Marketing and Communication Director Kriana Shepherd said officials from Getty, Epson, and AdNet Global, a post-production agency that specializes in digitization, restoration, and discoverability of visual analog historic libraries, will be on campus Thursday to set up the equipment that will be used to digitize our collection for the Getty Collection and teach staff and students how to operate it. It's a huge, culturally significant partnership. In addition to the grainy photo of the proud, erect students who were members of the school's 1923-24 graduating class that embodies the new Negro catchword, popular during that period, funding from the grant will support the digitization of archival photographs from the NCCU library, including stories of Black Wall Street in Durham and the school's sports history, as well as image of historical figures visiting the campus, such as the famed novelist and folklorist Zora Neale Hurston, pastor and politician Adam Clayton Powell, historian and author John Hope Franklin, and Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. In a word, campus officials are elated. Chancellor Johnson Akinleye said in January, North Carolina Central's rich history, vibrant culture, and steady growth over the past 111 years have been captured through images. The generous investment by Getty Images will offer new, technologically enhanced, and advanced ways in which we, as a leading historically Black university, can further tell our story. He added, the university's strategic partnership with the world's largest visual storytelling and preservation company will strengthen and elevate the importance of digitizing our important photographic collections that document the history of NCCU and other HBCUs that are institutional gems to our nation. The collaboration also trains the next generation of librarians, archivists, and public historians who will work with these priceless collections. The photos will launch on Getty.com as part of its Historically Black Colleges and Universities collection and will add thousands more photos throughout the year. NCCU archivists and librarians will work alongside the Getty Images archivists and AdNet Global. Cassandra Illich, Vice President of Partnerships with Getty Images, says, the Getty Image Photo Archive grants were created to honor the vast history of HBCUs and their contribution to American history. We are committed to preserving the visual narrative of all cultures and communities to ensure these vital artifacts are accessible to storytellers around the world. One of the grant judges, Deborah Willis, who is academic director, professor, and chair at New York's University Tisch School of the Arts, said the Getty Image Photo Archive grants is an essential part of the ongoing documentation and preservation of Black images at HBCUs. College officials said the school will retain copyright of its photos. Getty Images, in a statement, also noted the original photos will be returned to HBCUs after scanning, along with the newly digitized photos. Getty Images will represent the digitized photos, providing a new revenue source for the grant recipients. University officials added that 50% of the revenue generated from those images that are preserved will be funneled back to grant recipients, while 30% will be used for financial donation to a scholarship fund focused on furthering the education of students at HBCUs, with 20% earmarked for reinvestment to fund those grants each year. Friday's panel discussion, entitled Reframing Black Identity Through Photography, African-American Photographers and Their Works, will explore the role of HBCUs in documenting the history and culture of the African-American experience, according to a university statement. The panelists will highlight the politics of representation and omission and the role of African-American photographers in shaping the cultural landscape. Now, that discussion will be moderated by Andre Van, the coordinator of NCCU's University Archives and historian. The panel participants include Tracy Burns, Deputy Secretary of Diversity, Equity, Accessibility, and Inclusion with the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources for the state; Phyllis Coley, founder and publisher of Spectacular Magazine and host of Durham's annual Juneteenth celebration; Glenn Harris, an associate professor of history at UNC Wilmington; and NCCU student and photography entrepreneur Cleo Elise Cotton. And there are some websites to click on the online, again, indieweek.com. If you want more information about this grant or the discussion, there are places that you may click. All right, folks, here in the broadcast studio at NC Reading Service, it is past, way past lunchtime. I've been looking at this articles in Indie Week, and now I'm going to curtail all my important information and give you some crucial information. Some of the winners, the best of the Triangle 2022, and there's all sorts of ways I can go here. As I mentioned, there's hundreds of categories. What I will do is read this week the best in the Triangle or best in Wake County references only, and I'll read a short description of them from the reviewing staff at Indie Week. All of the other articles that I'll read next, well, it's not even articles, they're just mentions of all these places in Durham, Orange County, and Wake County. But here we go. Best bagel in the Triangle, Brandwine's Bagels. They're on Franklin Street, and it's the only bagel shop, and fills a very necessary niche. It's promised to serve classic New York bagels that are boiled and baked right here in Chapel Hill. It was opened by a UNC graduate in 2020. And there were some runner-ups, which I'm not going to read. Best Bakery in Wake County, La Farm. That's in Cary. Opened in 1999. It's a European-style bakery. Has grown in leaps and bounds. It's the neighborhood bakery everyone longs for. A welcoming local place where you can find breakfast, specialized ingredients for dinner party, or simply something on your regular grocery list. How about a Bloody Mary? Well, the best place to find one in the Triangle, it says, the Blind Pelican. And that's a seafood restaurant in Holly Springs. The best breakfast in Wake County, they list Flying Biscuit Cafe, and that's over in Cameron Village, just off of downtown Raleigh. Flying Biscuit Cafe, the best breakfast. And these, by the way, as I've mentioned before, these are determined by nominations and then votes by Indie Week readers. Best Caribbean or Cuban restaurant in the Triangle is Copa. And that's in the, they don't give a location, but it was harvested food from the owner's farm in Hillsboro, the nation's only farm-to-table Cuban restaurant, Copa. How about the best coffee shop in Wake County? Well, this one seems to win every year. It's Cup of Joe's over on Hillsboro Street near the campus of sleepy students at NC State. Best deli in the Triangle, the Mediterranean Deli. That's on Franklin Street location, but they have other locations as well. And best draft beer selection You can hear me selecting through here. The best draft beer selection is the Raleigh Beer Garden. That's a three-floor establishment over on Glenwood Avenue, the main downtown street. They set the world record for most beers on tap in 2015, 369 drafts. The best food truck in the Triangle, Chirba Chirba. That could appear anywhere. And smiling, dumpling-adorned truck, Chirba Chirba. The best Indian restaurant in the Triangle, as usual, is Vimala's Curry Blossom Cafe over in Chapel Hill. The best Japanese restaurant in Wake County, Waraji. And they are in Durali Road, and that's outside of the edge of Raleigh, between Raleigh and Durham, basically. A broad selection of sushi and sashimi. And going on, the best pie in Wake County, the Angus Barn, that towering metropolis almost over near the airport. The best restaurant in the Triangle, the best restaurant in the Triangle award goes to M. Sushi. In my opinion, the other three restaurants are equally deserving of this title, but that they're the first to launch, M. Sushi gets the most love. Let's see. We have... All right, now going on to... well, I have very little time left. I'll just continue now with moving on to other listings. The best burger in Wake County is Bad Daddy's Burger Bar. Now, this time you'll not hear any locations from me. The best burrito in Wake County, I happen to know where that one is, right near the governor's mansion in Raleigh, Gringo A Go-Go. The best cheap eats in Wake County, Guasaca. Guasaca. How about the best chef in Wake County? She almost always takes that order, Ashley Christensen, and her series of mind-blowingly good restaurants. Best Chinese restaurant in Wake County is 5-star. How about chocolate, anybody? The best chocolate in the Triangle, Videre Chocolate Factory, wins that one. Foundation is the winner of the best cocktail bar in Wake County. What about cupcakes? Best cupcake in the Triangle, Small Cakes, wins that. The best, let's see, best distillery in the Triangle, Durham Distillery. The best donut in the Triangle is Monuts, M-O-N-U-T-S. How about, we already have the best French restaurant in the Triangle is Vin Rouge. And Constantine and Lurline, our musical saw and piano duet of virtuosi, are playing us off from Indie Week this week. John Federson will hopefully be with you for next week's issue. And you can find this, of course, on our podcast section, because that's what it is, a podcast. And speaking for all the other pods at the North Carolina Reading Service, John Federson says, stay safe this hot weekend, please. Thank you.